man craves to worship. He will find something and make a god out of it. In this world, there are all types of gods. Some people worship the sun. Even snakes, rivers, trees, the dead, anything. I was in Singapore some years ago. I went into a Buddhist temple and I saw this lady in the act of worship. She had some charm blocks in her hands and she threw them down again and again and again like dice. And when they bounced the right way and the right combination came up, and then she bowed before the idol and folded her hands and went away happy. But God's claim to reverence and worship above the gods of the heathen is based upon the fact that He is the Creator, and that to Him all other beings owe their existence. And so we come to that passage of Scripture, Revelation 14:7, which says, "Worship Him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters." Now God asks some profound questions in the Bible, which are meant to stir our thinking. Job has a number of questions which cannot be answered. But if you brought your Bibles with you, I'd like to have you turn to Isaiah 40, verse 12. And listen to the question here. "Who hath measured the waters in the hollow of His hand, and meted out heaven with a span, and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure, and weighed the mountains in scales, and the hills in a balance?" And then again, over in the 25th, 26th verse, "To whom then will ye liken me, or shall I be equal, saith the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high, and behold, who hath created these things, that bringeth out their host by number? He calleth them all by names, by the greatness of His might, for that He is strong in power, and not one faileth." Now God, first of all, asks us to look above. He asks us to look to the heavens. He wants us to look above because He says in Psalms 96:5, "For all the gods of the nations are idols, but the Lord made the heavens." And the psalmist continues to say, "The heavens declare the glory of God." So as we look at our verse tonight, it begins with "Worship Him who made heaven." And from the shining stars, which some people think are just little tiny dots in the sky, we can learn some things about our Creator God. The galaxies and the unnumbered worlds. We realize a fraction of who this God is. Now let's take a quick look tonight and probe into space. I'm no astronomer, nor the son of an astronomer, but I'd like to have you look and to think. Because I remember one time talking to a prisoner he had about 10 to 15 years to serve in lockup. And he told me that in the hours of his loneliness, that he would look out through the bars and look up at the stars. And it gave him the hope that there was a God, not the gloomy cell, but there was a God. Now, first of all, I'll have to admit that it's very difficult for me to maintain and concentrate on 55 miles an hour. You don't need to tell local police this, but it's very difficult for me. I would rather travel at a mile a minute. But they didn't register it, that speed. But say that we could average at a mile a minute, 60 miles an hour. And to get some idea of the immensity of just the nearest object, if we were able to have a highway to the moon, and we're able to maintain that speed in a camper, and we had our own toilet facilities and everything else, and we could go night and day, nonstop at 60 miles an hour, 23 weeks and 5 days later, we would arrive at the moon. But that's slow, really. Astronomers use light units to express how far things are out there, and it really takes time to travel. Now, for instance, they measure light. I just turned this light on because in spite of the new light bulbs, it still is rather dark up here. Now, that light that comes down, or that begin to shine here, is traveling at 186,000 miles a second, or 11 million miles a minute. That means that you could go around the world in the equator 7.5 times in 1 second, or you could make it to the moon in little over a second. So one day you would travel 16 billion miles. You multiply that by 365 and you have what is known as a light year, or nearly 6 trillion miles. And some of our nearest stars, some of the ones we call near, are hundreds and hundreds of light years away. Now, Mount Palomar in Southern California is a fascinating place. I don't know whether you've ever been there or not, but I used to go up there on Sabbath afternoons and take a look at the great pictures of the stars. They won't let you look through the telescope. Someone wrote, you know, and scribbled on the bottom of one of those star charts, "In my Father's house are many mansions." But it staggers your imagination when you stop and think that that 200-inch Hale telescope up there is taking pictures night after night when they can. Realize that the light coming down and striking that plate they photograph left the suns up there, which are really stars, say a billion years ago, before our world ever came into existence, traveling, and finally striking that plate. Don't be disturbed by that. You see, our world was created in the beginning of time, not the beginning of eternity. Now, we're supposed to have 9 planets in our solar system. Someone the other day said that there's 10, but let's say that from all the textbooks we know about, there are 9 in our solar system, all revolving around the sun. Now, out there in the infinitude of space, there are unnumbered billions of worlds revolving around other stars that we can't even see. And what looks like a tiny, tiny dot in the sky may be an entire galaxy. You know what a galaxy is? Well, have you ever seen the Milky Way night? You go out at night, and I suggest for Christians to go walk among the stars. And you look up there at that Milky Way, it looks like a path in the sky. You're looking at the sliced end of the end like of a pancake. That's what you're looking at. It was a great, big, huge circle, and we're just one little dot out here. And our sun is a little dot. We don't know what it really looks like. But that is one galaxy. Just one. There are whole systems like the Milky Way. How many? The telescope in Mount Palomar has measured over 1 million galaxies in the bowl of the Big Dipper. I said you should walk among the stars to get your bearing. I do it a lot. In fact, if your truths were known, I find as much strength in my devotions personally with the things about me, and especially of the stars, as I do from the written word. That's what Adam and Eve had. That's what the patriarchs had. I discover God speaking to me. And I'll tell you a little secret what I do. And I have the young people that know me do this too. Because we like to see something. You know, we want to see something visible. And you go out walking. And you stop and think. You can see out here to the stars here, and you can look up here and see these stars here. But just imagine this great world of ours as a glass ball. And you could look through it. You'd see stars below you. The side. We're just a piece of cosmic dust. And you think of God's power, His ability to hold up the universe, the whole concept of God and His majesty and His power, suns and stars, everything moving, turning in circles, down to the minutest atom. And He knows and He's aware of everything. Time and space are incomprehensible to finite man. The problem is, we like beginnings and endings. When I write a book, I have a beginning and I have an ending. But I can't imagine anything that has no beginning and no ending. Did you ever read the story of the man who had a dream in that old book, Astronomy in the Bible? He had a dream about God's infinitude of space. And in this dream, an angel came up to him and said, Would you like to see how great the universe really is? Yes. We will strip you of all gravity, the pull of gravity, and we will give you the ability to fly with the angels. Far faster than light. Light is pokey. But we will retain your human heart. The heart that weeps and sobs, that can feel emotion. You come with me. And with that, the angel wheeled off into space with this man. And in his dream, he went off into the great corridors of time and space. And there were stalactites and stalagmites, and he saw like a great caverns, and he went through gates that looked like time immemorial. And he went off and on and on and on. And finally he said, I can't stand it. Is there no end? Is there no end to the universe of God? And the angel said, is that what bothers you? And then he lifted his glorious arms to heaven. He says, end, there is none to the universe of God. Lo, also there is no beginning. I say that to you because God wants us to grasp that fact. See, when Christ met Moses at the burning bush, and he told him to take off his shoe, and Moses was there with that crackling, burning bush. Moses said, who shall I say sent me? Going down to Egypt now. And that voice said, you tell them, I am that I am. God is always in the present tense. Those around the throne in heaven say, we give thee thanks, O Lord God Almighty, which are and wast and art to come. In the past, I am. Present, I am. In the future, I am. I'm always. I have always been. That is the reason why when you pick up the book of John in the verse and chapter 8, and Jesus has this confrontation with the Pharisees, who are you? This man of Galilee that looked travel-worn and dusty and looked like any other man. There wasn't any halo about him. He came as a man. And as you read that account, which is most thrilling, that confrontation, Jesus looked him right in the eye and he said, "Before Abraham was, I am." And it was at that point they picked up the stones and the rocks to kill him because they knew what he meant. He claimed to be God. Ellen White writes an interesting passage about the redeemed. She says, "With undimmed vision, they gaze upon the glory of creation, suns and stars and systems, all in their appointed order, circling the throne of deity." And if you look at the diagrams of an atom, and you study how the stars move, you begin to understand that all this is a pattern. And way out there somewhere, God is the center, the nucleus. And from his throne, stars and whole systems, everything is in motion. And they circle the throne of deity. To us, it doesn't look like they're moving, but they are. David had spent enough time with the stars to appreciate a little of God's omnipotence. He says, "When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him?" Now the power to create all this is something of an awesome concept. His majesty and power to create this. The power to produce, of splitting 1 ounce or a few ounces of uranium can destroy a city by splitting it. But you smash every atom of every blazing sun, whirling world, and mystery moon, and sweeping comet, and all God's universe, and only then would you have displayed the power God used in creating the universe. Now, as a film producer, I enjoy, privately, and few people except the few that know me well, know how I enjoy running the projector backwards. Usually when I'm producing a film, I quietly close the door and laugh. I have a lot of laughs. There is something hilariously funny to me about watching a smokestack come together after it's been blown up. I just enjoy watching the particles. You know, this great smokestack, and they blow it up, and then suddenly all the dust particles and everything comes together and you watch the thing form. I just enjoy that. I enjoy it because it does something inside me. It sort of reminds me of what probably it was like at creation time. For I read in Psalms 33, 6 and 9, "By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, and all the hosts of them by the breath of his mouth. For he spake, and it was done. He commanded, and it stood fast." You have crystallized energy. Christ is called the Word. He speaks. He is not dependent on pre-existing matter. We build a building, we have to have stone, we have to have brick, we have to have lumber, we have to have something. But not God. He speaks. And it is done. To create the innumerable suns, God had but to speak the word, you see. the whole host of them obeyed the breath of his mouth. But to bring forth the host of the saved, the Son of God, left glory and eternal blessedness to lead men from sin to the purity of God. And the next time you feel alone, the next time you feel like that you're lost out here in space, remember this same God who has that same kind of power, hasn't slacked a bit, otherwise we would disintegrate, can certainly answer your prayer, can certainly be close to you. He has all power to help you overcome any temptation or face any problem. That is the reason why you need to grasp this part of this first angel's messages. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. I like what Charles Spurgeon said. He said, in the heavens, God floats out a starry flag to show that the king is at home. He who looks up into the firmament and then writes himself an atheist brands himself at the same time as an idiot or a liar. The simple and sublime words of Genesis should bring us to our knees in worship. He made the stars also. But the verse says, he not only created the stars, but every living thing on earth and in the sea. Eternity alone will not be enough to comprehend the wonders. Now, I have a biologist friend, Dr. Ernest Booth. He's fascinated by all the realms of biology. And he tells me when he gets to heaven, one of the first things he wants to ask God is how the sap goes up a tree. Now, I'm not particularly interested in the sap going up the tree, but it would be one of the wonders. What makes the grass green? They say, well, it's chlorophyll. Well, what is chlorophyll? All the wonders. But I'd like to have you consider tonight just one small aspect of the natural world, because it ought to speak to us individually. And that is about bird migration. You see, year after year, billions of birds follow trackless skyways around the globe. The golden plover, the Arctic tern, and so forth. And in their tiny brains, God has placed the utmost skill and navigational aids. You know, not long ago, they got tired of having these albatrosses out there at Midway get in front of the jets, and they didn't want them there, and it was could cause some accidents. So they took some of these big, what they call goonie birds, and their nesting sites, and took the whole business, boxed them up, and crated them up, and took them to the Philippines, 4,120 miles away. That's a good hop, even in a jet. You know, they came back to the Midway Islands in 1 month. How'd they find that spot out there in the Pacific? That took another group clear to this state, Washington State. And they returned in 10 days with an average flying speed of 317 miles a day. Found that one place out there in the Pacific. But listen to this. They were shipping a little female bobolink by plane from Kenmare, North Dakota in late summer to Dr. William J. Hamilton of the California Academy of Sciences in Berkeley. That little bird, that little bobolink, was banded, but somehow she got out of her crate and escaped. Now, she's down there in Berkeley, California, but she didn't know. She didn't go to the travel agency to find out where she was. Now, the phone call came the next spring, and they had the same bird in North Dakota again. Same bird. She's banded. Now listen, the western bobolinks migrate as far south as Brazil. They never stay in the United States during the winter. But this little bird had to solve a problem of where she was when she escaped and get herself oriented. Somehow, this bird was able to compensate for her displacement by airplane from North Dakota make your way to the migrating ground, get turned around and go back home to North Dakota, solving a problem difficult even for all human navigational instruments. Scientists once thought that birds used one simple method. They realize now that they have a lot of combinations of methods, an astounding number of them. They use the sun, they use the stars, air masses, humidity, ether, radio waves, they use combinations. Who put this in their little brain? You see, long before the present scientific data was available, William Cullen Bryant caught the spiritual significance of this marvel. Remember that poem? From your childhood to a waterfowl. There is a power whose care teaches thy way along that pathless coast, the desert and illimitable air, long wandering but not lost. And then he says, he who from zone to zone guides through the boundless sky thy certain flight, in the long way that I must tread alone, will guide my steps aright. If he can do that for a little bobolink, or for an albatross, he certainly can do it for his children made in the image of God. And of course, the sea has its store of migratory wonders from the salmon, the shrimp, the eels. There's American and European eels. They breed right out there. They come out from the Dominican Bermuda, and they sort out, and some go to Europe, and some go to North America up there at the St. Lawrence River. 1 year for the American, 2 for the European, and they know these hatch. After they're hatched out, these young know exactly where to go. Worship Him who made the heaven, the earth, and the sea. All the wonders, and we are only just touching on a minute portion. The enemy is a keen student of the Scriptures, and the timing of events is important to his diabolical scheme and cause. He had to counteract the first part of the first angel's message. He had to plan it. And worship Him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. Did you ever wonder why someone didn't come up with the evolutionary theory centuries before? Why was it that Darwin came out with his Origin of the Species in 1859? Oh, they had toyed with it some years before in the other century. But it didn't fly, as we say. But now, after the first angel's message began to sound, now it took off. It wasn't by accident. Dr. Clark Pinnock, in his book Set Forth Your Case, wrote some interesting things. I don't know whether Seventh-day Adventists are that forthright in writing, but listen carefully. He said, every generation has its myths, and it's always easier to detect the myths of other cultures than our own. Anyone who would dare dispute it is considered foolish. All educated people in the 12th century knew the earth was flat. No other possibility was even considered. Evolution is a cultural myth of the 20th century. It offers to provide a total explanation of all reality without requiring man to answer to the God of creation. In fact, this is quoted from his chapter entitled The Grand Myth. Then he goes on to say, scientifically, the concept of evolution has almost outworn its usefulness. So many inner contradictions have been pointed out that the hypothesis has ceased to be helpful. Yet the brainwashing goes on. High school textbooks, educational TV, science programs, and the popular press continue to play on man's gullibility. Evolution, as if the term conveys a precise entity, is presented, quotes, as it happened. Charts and illustrations of life's progress over millions of years are shown. It would almost lead one to believe the magazine had live coverage. But modern man needs his myths badly. And remember that, and remember it well. The other night I watched public television program, science program, and they pitted evolution, thesis against creation. And each scientist built their models, and they argued back and forth, each convinced. It would make no difference how convincing a creationist can be, because the evolutionist can build his models. You need to go behind the scenes on why. Why this persistence in evolution, regardless of how much data and information you come up with. Now listen carefully. Evolution succeeds not because it is a sound theory, but because it bolsters a humanistic faith which modern man has foolishly adopted in place of the Christian gospel. It persists despite nature, not because of her. Every theory so far requires a miracle somewhere along the way greater than creation itself. The real point is, they do not want to bow down to the God of creation. I was visiting the Reuben H. Fleet Space Theater in San Diego. My wife and I sat in that theater. It's a very comfortable place. Sort of relax, get your head back. In fact, you can almost go to sleep. Air conditioned. It's the screen goes clear to the floor and clear up above you. Quadraphonic sound. And they say you will see 5 billion years compressed into 30 seconds as you watch a galaxy form. That is what the narrator says. And so you begin with creation. And so you sit there and you watch. And you're the rumbling. You can hear water lapping. You can't see anything yet, but you hear water lapping. Then suddenly you're jolted upright as a bolt of lightning strikes the water. They didn't tell you where the water came from. They didn't tell you where the bolt of lightning came from. But suddenly from the lightning striking the water, a little wiggler begins to wiggle in the water. Amazing. And it wiggles and wiggles and wiggles, and it comes to dry land. Well, I don't know where that came from either. And this little wiggler begins to grow legs. And you watch as this thing grows legs, looks finally like an ape, and then finally like a man. Marvelous. And I nudged my wife and I said, that takes a lot of faith to believe that. It does. Somewhere along the line, it requires greater faith in a miracle than creation itself. Man was made in the image of God. You know, the evolutionists believe, and their whole theory is built on the premise that as there is a need, there is some growth. Something happens because of a need. You get legs because you need to walk. And so on. But at a great science meeting some years ago, Dr. Chalmers from Andrews University raised his hand. He said, tell me, gentlemen, how can you explain that the human mind, brain, has millions of brain cells and they're not being used? Tell me. And these great doctors, science, wrestled with that problem. That is strange, isn't it? You have all these cells not being used. Never thought of that before. Finally, there was silence, and they turned to Dr. Chalmers, and they said, well, what do you think? And he said, because man was made in the image of God, he was built for eternity. The first angel's message will continue to sound till the end of time. It prepares men to receive the remainder of the other angels' messages, which we will discuss in the future. We're in desperate need right now to once again know the full meaning of the word worship, because the Sabbath is interlocked with this, bound up tightly with this, in worshiping Him who made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. We are dealing with the Sabbath. We're dealing with that weekly cycle and that time slot when we spatially meet with God in worship. Our concept of the deity will help us stand in the final trouble, day of trouble. No matter what the enemy throws at us, if we have this concept and we have this understanding of who God is, as I told you before in that first part on fear God, we will not fear, we will not be afraid of what little men can do or say. I remember meeting one time with an elder Schultz, who had been one of our first missionaries to Tibet. And he said he was translating the Bible in the Tibetan language. And he came to those first few words. In the beginning, God. And said, what word shall we use for God? And the Tibetan said, well, which God do you want? We have God of the rocks. We have the God of the waterfalls. We have God of the mountains, the God of the snow. Which God should we put down here? No, Elder Schultz said, I want the God of all, that created all of it. Well, we have no God like that. Well, then we'll have to make up a name. And the name in the Tibetan languages was a contrived name. They didn't have one. God, the Creator God. Worship Him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. Worship Him who can lead you and guide you, is my prayer.
This has been another classic sermon from the Archive of American Christian Ministries. International Copyright 2008, all rights reserved. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.